no, no.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We gotta get those vocal warm-ups in. And on that note, actually, that was a great time for you to do your warm-ups, Tim.
Did you just turn it on?
I had just turned it on, so welcome, everyone. Oh, it's so good to have you all here. We've got Tim and Dan both in the studio today. It is a lovely Wednesday morning. We're recording a little later in the week than we normally do and earlier in the morning than we usually do, so we might be a little bit slow. And so, actually, on that note, I wanted to start off with a non-theological question, necessarily, potentially. When you guys are waking up in the mornings, if you have to wake up much earlier than you normally do, do you have any tips and tricks for how to do that and how to wake up well and not necessarily grumpy?
Go to bed early.
Sounds like a personal question. Oh, I don't know. Everybody's different if they're a morning person or not. I know, like, I got to give myself a certain amount of time.
Okay.
So that, you know, I'm ready to do whatever I need to do. Wednesday mornings are usually a little earlier for me because we have a men's Bible study. But I know I got to get up a certain amount of time before I need to leave. Mm-hmm. And the earlier that is in the morning, sometimes the less I want to put there, but the more I might need to kind of get my juices flowing. But
fair enough.
Yeah, me too. If I'm preaching Sunday morning, I'm up by 6, even though, you know, it's 3.5 hours till the service starts. But it just takes a while to get the mind going and everything else. And
yeah. I found that what I'll end up doing is I'll set one alarm for a half hour before I need to actually wake up. And then when that alarm goes, I'll actually move over and, like, lie on the couch and turn on, like, my plant light, my vitamin D light for the winter stuff. So then I've got some movement in. I'm still resting. I've got a light going. And that kind of helps, but I'm always on the lookout for new tips and tricks from those who are more experienced than I am.
We've had more sleeps than you.
Or potentially less.
That's true.
Awesome. Well, Tim, could you give us a quick refresher on the sermon from Sunday? It was a really, really good sermon. I appreciated it.
Thank you. Yeah, we're moving ahead in the storyline, so we went from Judges to Kings, and actually 1 Samuel still, but the not the very beginning of the monarchy, but really the beginning of the great king and the anointing of David by Samuel. So just the story of how the Lord orchestrated that, really, and what he was doing and how David becomes a type and forerunner of Christ in so many ways. Mm-hmm. Didn't get into that near as much as we could have, but
fair enough. One of the things that kind of stuck out to me, and this is speaking as someone who's a firstborn, so every time someone talks about birth order, you know, I got the book The Firstborn Advantage when I turned 12. So, you know, birth order was something I was always kind of interested in.
So these stories threaten you as a firstborn.
A little bit. A little bit. But I was wondering, because we do know a fair bit about the cultural benefits of being a firstborn in that era. You know that they received most, if not all, of the inheritance. Aside from the inheritance, what were some of the assumptions and benefits of being firstborn, and what makes it so significant culturally that David was a lastborn? Like, were there any other layers to that?
There's probably way more layers than I'm aware of. I know that culturally those kind of assumptions often run deep and aren't necessarily articulated. Mm-hmm. But you see that still today. There are families that are highly patriarchal who still treat the sons differently than the daughters, who value them. And it's a whole package deal, right? And I think in the ancient earth or the ancient world, the son, I mean, he carried on the name for one thing. So even in the inheritance laws that Israel had, the sons inherited it. And there's a special story for Zelophehad, who had 8 or 9 daughters and no sons, and how they were going to handle that. So, you know, everything's wrapped up in that. And then the firstborn, of course, got the double inheritance. There was certainly that privileged position for the firstborn son, even over other sons. But yeah, so being the lastborn, I don't know if it's any significance that he's last. Even second would have been, you know, like Jacob and Esau. Secondborn got the favors there. But it's been pointed out, too, we didn't talk about it on Sunday, but there were 7 sons and then David. And it's almost like there's this bigger theme of 7 is the creation, and 8 is almost a new creation. It's almost like God saying, I'm starting something totally new, which really points to Jesus, right, who is the new king. He's the new beginning of the new creation.
Okay.
And so there's that as well. And so the fact that he's the eighth born might have some significance.
That is very interesting. I hadn't noticed that. And then, so also like looking at those middle children, there wasn't necessarily, like if you were a middle child, it was as good as being the last kind of.
Yeah, I think that so. Is, I mean, I don't know, Dan, you can maybe speak into that.
Yeah, there was responsibility that came with being the oldest son too, that you kind of took charge of the household then, which meant in some ways you're caring for and making sure your younger siblings are taken care of. A lot of times they all lived in the same mm-hmm. compound too. We don't do that really as much anymore. I haven't come across something that said like from third to fifth, sure. if that was any different
That's
or to
absolutely
last.
Fair.
Although just naturally, kind of, I think you brought this out Sunday, Tim, kind of like, oh yeah, the youngest, you know, especially when you have that many kids.
You almost forget they're there.
Yeah, I mean, like some, there's, you know, 15, 16 perhaps years of age difference
right.
there, maybe more. So it's like, oh yeah, he's our 10-year-old and I'm 25.
You
right. know? He's kind of, yeah, just a baby. Mm-hmm. So there is just some of that natural, like, oh yeah, I'm kind of the grown up as well of the family
right.
as far as the kids are concerned. So.
And maybe it points to the short-sightedness we have too. Like these older sons, they were ready to be king. They were
mm-hmm.
old. They were strong men. And David was still a kid,
mm-hmm.
right? But God is thinking longer term mm-hmm. already.
So mm-hmm. what does God choosing this last-born kid have to say about the cultural assumptions we now have about who's gifted to lead and who's gifted to lead, both, you know, kingdoms and in the church? Because David was kind of doing both of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we delight in these stories in part because it just turns our assumptions upside down.
Mm.
We all have them. We still have them about who's the leader, right? And I have to point out a little bit on Sunday, but we still favor people who are taller. No offense, Dan.
None taken.
But you're better looking, so.
A lot of good it does me.
But it's just interesting to read some of those studies how, you know, even presidential candidates do better if they're taller, mm-hmm. right? And there's been other studies that women who are better looking make more money, right? They have higher status. There's just all kinds of stuff like that. And, of course, we look at other externals as well, status, where you live, the car you drive, the watch you have on. We just are naturally external in the mm-hmm. way we look at things. And then I guess we could also say when we look at traits of leadership, there's certain cultural assumptions we have about the traits that we value,
mm-hmm.
right? Somebody
mm-hmm.
who, and maybe an American, somebody who's more of a rugged pioneer, who can take the reins and, you know, tame the wilderness.
Mm.
Different cultures might value different mm. things that way.
On that note, this is a bit of an aside, but I've heard that there is, in some companies in Japan, will often hire someone to fill the role of the American. And what the American in this company does is they're the one who is allowed to and encouraged to just tell the boss they're being stupid.
Yeah, interesting.
Which is just very interesting.
Yeah.
Again, there's so many different cultural assumptions
right.
of what we look for in our businesses and in our companies.
Mm. Even the male-female thing, right? Like, we're still pretty male-dominated culture here, even though we're more egalitarian than others. But places like the Philippines have had female presidents, and they're much more matriarchal.
Mm.
And they just they accept that female leadership, even.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
very
yeah.
interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. This story, you know, you mentioned verse 7, I think, of the text, how that, you know, the Lord looks at the heart, and it does challenge our what really matters or what really makes a good leader.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. Oftentimes, we are just drawn to certain external or cultural factors rather than maybe character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah, that's hard. I mean, you read all the books, are leaders born or are they made?
Mm-hmm.
It kind of gets into that mm-hmm. challenge or that tension between kind of physical characteristics or maybe just, yeah, this person's character. And there's gifts that are needed for leadership. David clearly has those. If you go through the David story, this is a remarkable person.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly he, people followed him. Even when he's just this vagabond in the wilderness, people are drawn to him and they're coming around David and he's a natural leader. He's got gifts for leadership, but to me, one of the reminders is, and not just because I'm shorter, but but that God does go about things his own way. You mentioned even some of the others, you know, who weren't firstborns. I am shocked to see how often, in reality, it wasn't the case, because that was a huge deal in the culture. The firstborn got this. And you go right through, and, if you know, whether it's Seth right from the beginning, or then it's Isaac, who's not the firstborn of Abraham. That's
right.
Ishmael.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Esau, it's Jacob. Mm-hmm. Joseph is, you know,
seventh or eighth, right?
Yeah, way down the line. And even Judah is not first, who mm-hmm. ends up being the line of Christ. I mean, you go out, even Joseph's sons end up being the cross arms with the blessing there. You go down, Moses is not the oldest. Again and again, God kind of seems to say, I know how you all work,
right?
But I work a different
it's
way.
It's a dominant theme. It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. God's choices are often not the first.
Yes, and that just sticks in and challenges me, you know, even as we think of our local community and staffing and that, you know, and if we're filling a staff role, you're always looking for certain things. And often it has to do with maybe competence. But you're right, the physical characteristics, we don't have them on the list, but they are there.
They're functioning in the background.
Yes.
The only reason I got this job is because I look so good, right?
Your beard in specific.
Has nothing to do with the talent.
We are all firstborn sons in this room, too.
That is
we're not the oldest in our families all, but...
True. Huh. That is true. So take what we're saying.
So much salt. On the topic, though, of leaders in our church and just, you know, God choosing leaders, that was one of the things we talked about, how God chooses our leaders. And we know that that's obviously very true, but how does that kind of work and how do we wrestle with it when the leaders that have been chosen and given this responsibility are corrupt? You know, because we look at Samuel's sons, who they were next in line, and so then Saul came up, and God picked Saul, and Saul was super corrupt. So he's like, okay, we're going to move on to David. And David was infinitely better than Saul, but still, when you look at it, he wasn't a great guy overall. He was super flawed.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we hold these two things in both hands at the same time? Because, how do we Sorry, let me read this so I can actually read it properly. How can we reconcile our knowledge that God chooses the people who will lead us with the reality that it seems very often the leaders he ordains are just as corrupt and self-serving as worldly leaders?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's just reality, right? I mean, somebody had said, isn't it amazing that God uses all these flawed people? And the answer was, yeah, but he only has sinners to work with.
Mm.
Right? It says that's all he's got here on earth to work with. All the perfected ones are in heaven.
Mm.
So, we're going to have flaws, and there's going to be failures, right? Mm-hmm. All of the kings of Israel, even the kings of Judah who, you know, were faithful, still all had flaws, which points to they're still waiting for the perfect king, right? It just points to Jesus. You know, we're looking for a perfect king, somebody who's going to, you know, exhibit all these characteristics perfectly. We talked about that in the Hebrews study this morning, right? Like, finally, Jesus is perfect. He lived a perfect human life in the midst of a sinful world, which is so, so incredible.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think remembering that God is the leader for us as Christians, right? He's the one in charge. I thought of, you know, listening to your question, how God and when the people went into exile, talks about how Nebuchadnezzar or Cyrus is kind of doing his will. And I can imagine myself as a person, an Israelite at that time, thinking, why in the world are you working through this pagan ruler? But you're right, when it comes down to it, whether it was Babylon's king or Israel's king, they're all flawed. Some maybe are more pointed toward God than others, of course, but at the end of the day, if God's not leading, it's all going to be a mess, and our hopes can't be in our human leaders. That, for me, is where it keeps coming back to, because we are still prone to put our hopes in human leaders, whether that's in the church, politically, organizationally. We say, oh, now, you know, even from a sports, I follow a lot of sports, like, oh, this coach comes in, now the promised land, right? And it never goes that way. I don't care what the organization is, what the political party. The person, the people, are always going to let us down other than Jesus and other than the Lord himself. So that reminder for me that it's wonderful God works through us as flawed people, because otherwise there'd be no story. But we have to keep putting our hope in him. He's the true leader. And we do have to hold each other accountable, especially in the church, right? To say, like, hey, we're getting off track here. Or Dan, you're following your own whims and not, you know, pointing to the way of the Lord. But part of this is just being humble and saying, we're given this role. I have this role for a time, but I'm not it.
You know, that tension is there in the establishment of the monarchy in Israel, right? Because And even in that story, right, who's the actor? God's the main actor. He's directing the show. But Samuel is brought in, who is the prophet, who hears the word of the Lord and obeys the Lord. And he's reasserting that the king is to be under the covenant with the Lord. And that was Saul's failure, it says several times, but he did not obey. He did not obey. And so, yeah, constantly getting back to, we are all serving under the true king. And to whatever extent we do that, we are successful.
So then as we go and choose our leaders, whether that's, you know, organizationally or whether we're a sports team or whether we're looking for a politician and we're choosing who we're going to elect, how do we know whether, as we're looking to fill this role, whether I'm trying to phrase this well, is we're operating under the anointing versus what we want as sinful people. How can we discern whether that leader is one that, you know, God's anointing here, or and that's why we're, you know, voting for them, or we're hiring them, or we're doing whatever, versus this person has all the qualities that I really like. How do we discern that?
Well, I think for one thing, it sometimes takes time. Jesus said, by their fruit you will know them. And fruit doesn't come right away. It's hard to identify trees in the winter when there's no leaves. It gets better in the spring, but it's really clear in the fall.
My brother's a forestry major, actually, and he said the exact same thing. He's like, man, you cannot tell what a tree is in the middle of the winter.
There's fewer things to distinguish it. So in some ways, I think that's comforting. Like, you're not going to just be able to tell instantly, always. Some people present really well, but over time, their true character starts to show. So I think it just takes time. And then looking for the fruit of character, right? Like, there are a lot of traits that make persons gifted. They may be very intelligent. They may be eloquent. They may have powerful ideas. But if character's not there behind it and beneath it, then it's going to be a bad show.
You know, I was thinking similarly. That character piece is huge, and you're right. You know, if you're out here and you're someone who interviews for positions or jobs, it's hard to get a real window into someone's character in a couple interviews. Maybe we have more data now because you can look at someone's social media profile or something like that. But it's hard to judge that until you're in pressure situations where that's really being tested. Because I can act pretty well when things are fine, but then when the stress comes, when the pressure's on, that's when sort of our true fruit comes out, right? When the fall comes. So yeah, that character is important. And I've heard that. I've heard it from people in the church, you know, leaders in the church who have written and said, you know, we came to realize that if the character wasn't there, it didn't matter how competent someone was, how well they got along with other workers, it still wasn't going to go well.
Right.
And even outside the church, I've heard that so often. And again, I follow a lot of sports, and you see that with coaches, like, boy, this person seems to win wherever they go, but they change jobs every 3 years because the character is suspect. Whether the way they go about recruiting or the way they relate to people, it just isn't going to go well. And so you're right. That to me is, and for us in the church, it points back to Christ-like character, which ties into the humility we talked about. And I think of Samuel. I really appreciated, Tim, your emphasis there on, you know, God leading the action and driving this action. He's the one taking the initiative. It's not Samuel. It's not David or Jesse. And I thought of Samuel, too, and I know he'd had a few years of this, but he was the leader for a while. And now, like Austin, you said, his sons weren't going to be it. They asked for a king. It was Saul. That didn't seem to go well. There's still got to be a part of him that's like, well, maybe it's going to come back to me. He's got to hand this over and be willing to say, I must become less and someone else is going to become greater. And I appreciate that of Samuel's following. He was humble to say, okay, I'm going to take this lesser role now. Even though the people acknowledge how faithful he had been over many years leading. And that's not easy humanly to do, but it's recognizing this is God's
show. There's a lot to be said for Samuel in that text we didn't talk about, but like he receives the word of the Lord. He discerns the Lord speaking. You know, he's sensitive to the Lord. The Lord gives him very specific instructions. Samuel raises his objections. But when in the end, it says very clearly, Samuel did what the Lord said. And then it tells exactly, he went with a heifer, he filled his flask, and he invited Jesse. He just almost word for word, he does the things that the Lord instructed him. It's this picture of obedience and humble service. So yeah, he is the wizened prophet, the reason that Israel followed him so mm-hmm. well.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the discussion and the thoughts, guys. This has been incredible. Dan, could you give us a quick peek under the hood at what this next Sunday will look like?
Absolutely. We're going to continue with David's story. We're just at the beginning. We're going to skip ahead to the end of his story, or toward the end, when he's thinking about building a temple for the Lord. And this is 2 Samuel 7, and it's an important passage. In fact, I was reading some commentaries this week that say it might be the most important passage in the Old Testament, which really? Is quite a statement to make. But I think as we get into it, we see, because there's this covenant formed, and it's an unconditional covenant, whereas that wasn't always the case between God and his people before then. There was always an if, but here it's nevertheless, even when your son, you know, goes astray, I won't take my love from you. So it's this covenant God makes with David's family. He builds a dynasty really for them, and it points again to what he's going to do in Jesus of the line of David. But yeah, I'm looking forward to spending some time with it with everyone this coming Sunday morning. So
yeah, so am I. That sounds really exciting. Mm-hmm. I cannot wait. Well, thank you both again for doing this. This is, as always, such a pleasure. Thank you to everyone listening for joining us and being a part of this discussion. I hope you all are a lot more awake than we are by the time you hear this. Yeah, but go in peace, and we'll see you next week.